The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if the Christian message is really about confessing our sins, then why can't America, as a country, confess its sins? Why can't America admit how horrible of a country it is and confess the fact that maybe we asked for 9/11? And you'd be surprised how many people seriously embrace this sad point of view. Maybe some of you out there embrace that, and I know that if you do, you're doing that sincerely. Now, a couple of weeks ago, the 10th anniversary of 9/11 was observed by our country, not celebrated, nothing to celebrate, obviously, but observed as a day of remembrance, as a day of reflection. And on that day, which happened to come on a Sunday, I was away on a speaking engagement, actually preaching in a couple of church services about the lessons that we can learn as Christians from 9/11. Consequently, my radio show aired a repeat broadcast that day. So today, since the impact of 9/11 continues to affect us all year round anyway, I would like to back up for just a few minutes and begin today's program by sharing a few thoughts that I might have shared if I had been here in the studio live on the 10-year anniversary. Now, 10 years ago, I was actually there. I was at Ground Zero almost 1 month to the day of 9/11/01, and smoke was still coming up out of the ground, even though planes had hit the World Trade Center some 4 weeks prior. Naturally, I'd seen this picture on TV, but nothing could prepare me for standing by the actual spot, looking through a fence as bulldozers continued to dig and military guards kept the area secure. Horrific as the images looked on television, there was just something about this pivotal piece of history which called out to me. I wanted to look Ground Zero square in the eye. How hard to believe that two majestic towers once shot up proudly from this very spot. As an itinerant Christian minister, I'd already been scheduled to speak at a retreat and other places in upstate New York. In fact, my ticket had been sent to me long before 9/11. When the time for my tour finally arrived, I hoped that between lectures I might make a trip into the city. Scheduled to speak at SUNY College in Albany the next morning, after finishing a weekend mountain event that would go until afternoon, the only chance of squeezing in a trip to Manhattan was late at night. Middle of the morning, really. I managed to talk a few college students into taking me, but the girl with the car agreed only under one condition. She and her friends would navigate. I would drive. I've got to tell you, my first experience driving through downtown New York helped me to understand immediately why those familiar with the Big Apple preferred not to bring their car anywhere near this metropolitan island. Even at 3 a.m, most of the traffic seemed to flirt with death, and the driving habits of cabbies left much to be desired. But in any event, we made it. We got there. Here we stood now at Ground Zero. Some of the students were shocked into silence. Others were teary-eyed. And to my left, I saw that we had been joined by a middle-aged couple, staring out at the rubble, looking quite pensive. So I turned to them and I said, "Did you know somebody who died here?" "Well, yes, they knew a woman who worked in one of the towers. I don't remember which one. I do remember that they had come all the way out from California, where I had come from. And like me, they also had to just witness this hellhole for themselves." All at once, the wife said something that I'll never forget. She said, "I'd just like to understand what we could have done which made them hate us so much." I said, "Maybe we didn't do anything. Maybe some people just enjoy hatred. Maybe some people are simply evil." Oh, I could see that my answer made no sense to her. Evil? No, people only commit terrible acts for a reason. There must be something they want. There must be a problem with the way we've treated them. Nobody is evil just for evil's sake. Her words concerned me, but did not surprise me, because for a month now, I had been hearing similar ideas from one television pundit after another talking about what happened at Ground Zero. And it occurred to me that many Americans were suffering from a national version of battered wife syndrome. You know what I mean when I say battered wife syndrome. Having once been a pastor who occasionally counseled such women, I'm very sympathetic to their plight. Asking a mother to take her children and leave a violent man is far more easily said than done. Still, most sensible people cringe when they hear women blaming themselves for their husband's violent abuses. "Oh, he only got mad because I provoked him. It was all my fault." Or, "Well, my husband acts this way because of his own abusive childhood." Or, "Well, I know he really loves me because he apologizes after he hits me every single time, and sometimes he even buys me flowers." Ironically, many who would challenge such a person to secure a restraining order and stop creating excuses offer a few excuses of their own for terrorists who seek to destroy the United States and other civilizations. Sometimes we even take our cues from the moderate Muslims, and I'm using moderate in quotes, Muslims who come on TV and say things like, "Well, we renounce the terrorism, of course, but we do hope America has learned its lesson about always taking Israel's side. If there were a two-state solution, perhaps there would be less terrorism." Oh, yes, of course, that makes perfect sense. "And if a picked-on third grader gave a bully half his peanut butter and jelly sandwich, the bully would be so appreciative, he'd turn over a new leaf instead of finding the same short, skinny kid in the playground one day later demanding all of his pastrami on rye with mustard." Actually, Israel agreed to a two-state solution in 1947, when the United Nations legally established two separate countries, one for the Jews and one for the Palestinians, who did not call themselves Palestinians in those days, but instead described themselves as Arabs. There's never been a country called Palestine. The Jews agreed. The Arabs did not agree to the two-state solution. And then Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq all declared war on Israel. Amazingly, they lost the war. But modern Israel's beginning proved right from the start that a two-state solution was the farthest thing from her enemies' minds. Folks, the situation has not changed. You don't believe me? Watch Palestinian leaders in television interviews hem and haw when asked if Israel has a right to exist. "Oh, it is complicated. It is complicated." Yeah, it's complicated. Not as complicated as you'd imagine. You want Israel dead, period. I don't really think it's all that complicated. "Well, okay, Bob, we'll forget about America taking Israel's side for now. Maybe there are other reasons. Maybe the U.S. made other blunders in the Middle East, such as our greedy quest for oil. If we weren't so interested in oil, terrorists wouldn't be attacking." Well, our oil-motivated Middle East relationships do create strange bedfellows. And there is room for honest debate about how much we should be working with countries such as Saudi Arabia. But that doesn't explain why a radical Muslim kills somebody in the Philippines. Neither does it excuse the murder of Dutch film director Theo van Gogh, who was making a movie about how women are treated in Muslim countries. Oil can't account for such actions. Neither can Israeli-Palestinian borders account for such actions. But sometimes a note, such as the one attached by knife to Van Gogh's dead body, will offer more authentic reasons. Scribbled on the paper were verses from the Quran and a call to holy war. Sweet. It's time to let the terrorists speak for themselves. In 2006, a video arrived from Al-Qaeda instructing Americans to convert to Islam or die. It's not about oil. It's not about Israel. It's about converting to Islam or dying. The note said to Americans, and the rest of Christendom, we say either repent your misguided ways and enter into the light of truth, or keep your poison to yourself and suffer the consequences in this world and the next. Ladies and gentlemen, let's be clear. We are hated by militant Islam because we are unwilling to convert to militant Islam. Not only have they admitted as much, their own scriptures contain the marching orders, the Quran. Surah 9, this is just one of many verses, but Surah 9, Prophet, make war on the unbelievers and the hypocrites and deal rigorously with them. Hell shall be their home. They uttered the word of unbelief and renounced Islam after embracing it. Now, I know it isn't politically correct to quote such a verse because it shows that the followers of such verses are part of a violent religion.
When Bob Siegel claims that Islam is a violent religion, he doesn't mean to imply that there are no peaceful Muslims at all.
Thank you, Dan. We always appreciate the special assistance of Disclaimer Dan.
In fact, a peaceful Muslim was discovered once by the famous paleontologist Paul Sergeevich, and the fossil remains can be found today in the Smithsonian Institute.
Okay, seriously, those jihad verses are not the only ones in the Quran. There are also passages which talk about peace, but make no mistake, both sets of words are in there. While we can be grateful that many Muslims focus only on the peaceful verses, we are foolish and naive if we do not acknowledge that many others take their jihad commands quite seriously. But that doesn't finish the explanation. Sincere as a religious person may be, by the time his religion is asking him to slit a stewardess's throat, or ram a plane into a building, or blow up a bus with children, the term evil becomes more authentic than the term zealous. It's time for America to stop acting like a battered wife. Making excuses for our enemy only emboldens our enemy. Terrorists view the excuse as a sign of weakness and inspiration for further attack. But then again, maybe the real problem is that Osama bin Laden's mother never bought him a sled when he was a kid. I suppose all that desert might have had something to do with it, but maybe she didn't buy him a sled in the midst of this madness. God does work. He honors countries that are just. He honors America when America returns to its founding principles, principles of justice, principles of freedom. And yes, obeying God was one of the principles of America, too. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Don't let them rewrite our history. And God works in Israel, despite the many United Nations members trying to sell her down the river, despite the fact that right now the Palestinians are asking for a separate state that will allow no Jews. And yet in this agreement, this new agreement, Israel's supposed to open up its borders and let just as many Palestinians flood back into there as they can. They call that the right of return. Yeah, that's very consistent. Very consistent. But God is working in Israel despite the United Nations. And he works in your own personal life, even when he seems far away. And maybe today, right now, he seems far away. But he works in your life. Just as Joseph had to remember by faith that God was there, just as Moses had to remember the same thing, we too can take comfort that God is in our life and he'll do miracles in our life.
Many nights we prayed with no proof anyone could hear. In our hearts a hopeful song we barely understood. Now we are not afraid, although we know there's much to fear. We were moving mountains long before we knew we could. There can be miracles when you believe, though hope is real. Hard to kill. Who knows what miracles you can achieve when you believe? Somehow you will. You will when you often proves in vain. Hope seemed like the sun.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. We are going to move on to our Bible portion of the program a little later on. I've been doing a lot of Bible shows lately the last few weeks. Today, I think I need to catch up some on because there's a lot going on politically, especially with these GOP candidates. But coming up, very interesting question. Some of you who study the Bible have probably wondered this. John the Baptist, people came up to John the Baptist and asked him if he was Elijah. The prophet, you may recall that Elijah the prophet had not died. He was actually taken up into heaven alive. I know my atheist friends don't believe there's a heaven. But if we believe what the Bible says, that's exactly what it says happened to Elijah. And it was predicted that before the Messiah came, Elijah the prophet would come. Well, John the Baptist was reminding people of Elijah. He seemed to have a similar personality. So the Jewish rabbis went out into the Jordan where John the Baptist was baptizing people. And they asked him if he was Elijah, and John the Baptist said very clearly, no. Later on, though, Jesus said he was Elijah. Do we have a contradiction with the Bible? We do not, but I'll tell you why later on today's program, something to look forward to. Meanwhile, indulge me with a few more politics. Herman Cain and the straw poll. I love Herman Cain. Love this guy, African Americans who are conservative, boy, they get the regular run-of-the-mill racism. And then they have to put up with a kind of reverse racism from other African Americans because they're conservatives. People are calling the guy an Oreo, meaning he's black on the outside, but he's white inside. I mean, it's horrible. But anyway, Herman Cain won the straw poll. And his straw poll victory in Florida may be a result of some bone honest sincerity. Unlike so many others, with Cain, what we see seems to be what we get. That's true. The man does not have as much experience, at least not as much political experience, as other GOP candidates, but he wears this anti-credential as a badge of honor. Knowing how sick and tired our country is of professional politicians and how desperate they are to find a successful businessman who knows how to create a variety of jobs, not merely green jobs or government jobs or union jobs or any of the other job categories likely to just reelect the hand that feeds them. On matters like foreign policy, I wish Kane had more experience. But then, when we recall candidate Obama's glowing foreign resume and President Obama's attempts to appease our enemies with every gimmick short of red roses and a box of See's candies, Kane's logical mind and sincere convictions come across as a breath of fresh air. The fact that his moral compass hasn't had its needle twisted by the tolerant fingers of political correctness is another plus. Unfortunately, candidates least likely to win tend to speak the most honestly in pre-primary debates, probably because they have nothing to lose. Once the base looks secure, they move toward the center faster than a busy waiter in a crowded restaurant asks if you're done working on your plate while lifting the plate away from you before you've answered the question. So who knows what we might hear from Kane should he ever eclipse Romney and Perry. Will he become the very candidate he challenges? Perry, you'll recall, confidently entered the race as if Super Tuesday were only a formality. Enter those pesky debates. The poor guy never knew what hit him. Not that debating ability or lack thereof should be our sole barometer of a candidate's effectiveness. The wittiest soundbite, the snappiest comeback, the sharpest tie, and the coat hanger forged smile mean absolutely nothing. There's another little matter called policy. Unfortunately, Perry came up short here as well. The Texas governor's defense concerning state-assisted education for children of illegal aliens drew boos from a crowd of conservatives, Tea Party conservatives, and he looked quite surprised because these are his people. He was surprised, but his tie still looked great. Could Perry have been so confident of Tea Party support that he was already making a play for those coveted independents? Rick could still ricochet by admitting that he made a mistake, or should a call for greater honesty be warranted, by confessing that his policy was more about catering to an Hispanic voting bloc and less about having a heart. Not that his performance in the previous debate was anything to brag about. On that day, he and Romney almost seemed to cancel each other out with slicing and dicing, but no matter how many times they sliced it, it was still baloney. Let's be honest. Both Mitt Romney and Rick Perry have serious flaws. That's certainly no breaking news flash, merely an unfortunate fact. Time does not permit us to discuss every flaw. This is a radio show, after all, not a recital of the book War and Peace. Instead, I will be just brassy enough to ghostwrite two small speeches which could turn things around for the candidates. Each testimony is a little more honest and penitent than what we generally observe in a debate or a television interview where talking points run out the clock and suck oxygen out of the room before a follow-up question can make its way out of the gate. Here's a speech that I'd like to hear from Mitt Romney. No more double talk about my Massachusetts health care plan. No more Newspeak-style distinctions about how mandatory insurance is okay on a state level, but unconstitutional as federal law. That may be technically true since states can write their own constitutions, but when I appeal to the conservative base by promising to end Obamacare, I cannot pretend that allowing states to do the same thing is really any more palatable. I've been kidding my voters and kidding myself to think that any of them will buy this reheated Jiffy Pop. It's like a used car salesman selling a car without brakes, and then later on selling his disgruntled customer brakes as an add-on. Oh, did you want brakes? You should have ordered the deluxe model. Enough of this. I made a stupid mistake with Romney Care. I am not going to defend it by fitting a square peg in a round hole. Instead, rest assured, if anyone knows the pitfalls of government health care, it is I, your old pal Mitt. Wouldn't you like to hear Mitt Romney give a speech like that. Now, with Perry, the redemption is a bit trickier. The immigration thing is just the latest. He also made some inaccurate comments about Romney in the previous debate. Now, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. Possibly he never even read Mitt Romney's book, which came up in the CNN-sponsored debate. Perhaps he referred to such literature in response to one of his campaign advisors. Nobody knows at this point, but that interpretation alone allows Perry to place the best smiley sticker he can on an otherwise disastrous evening. And I'll tell you how Perry could save his campaign when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Okay, I was talking about what Mitt Romney could do to come clean in a speech. Here's what Rick Perry could say to come clean in a speech. He could say, I was less than truthful during our CNN debate. No, I did not lie, but I repeated faulty information. When I insisted that Governor Romney also called Social Security criminal, I was following a suggestion from one of my advisors. What Mitt actually said in his book was that it would be criminal for the government to raid our Social Security system after promising that money was being set aside for retired citizens. And to be especially fair, I, Rick Perry, am going to now quote from Mitt Romney's book so you can hear what he actually said in context. My opponent, Mitt Romney, said, let's look at what would happen if someone in the private sector did a similar thing. Suppose two grandparents created a trust fund, appointed a bank as trustee, and instructed the bank to invest the proceeds of the trust fund so as to provide for their grandchildren's education. Suppose further that the bank used the proceeds for its own purposes, so that when the grandchildren turned 18, there was no money for them to go to college. What would happen to the bankers responsible for misusing the money? They would go to jail. But what has happened to the people responsible for the looming bankruptcy of Social Security? They keep returning to Congress every 2 years. When Mitt confronted me and asked to be quoted in context, I had no idea in the heat of the moment if my opponent or advisor was telling the truth. Wanting to win the debate, I went with my advisor, but I have since learned and now freely admit that I was wrong. I didn't lie. I was misled. I'll have to check my records to see what my debate advisors are being paid for those catchy little zingers. But offhand, I'd say whatever the amount, it's too much. Okay, folks, I believe each man would help his campaign by light years if such words poured out of their hearts. Oh, yeah, dream on, Bob. Dream on, Bob. Santa sliding down the chimney and accidentally hitting a calendar-challenged Easter bunny seems more believable than politicians coming clean and admitting that they were less than truthful. Well, perhaps. Perhaps. But two things should be remembered. First, people can be very forgiving when mistakes are confessed. Indeed, these candidates might just gain new respect from many. And second, this would distinguish the Republican hopefuls from our current president, who doesn't seem capable of taking responsibility for anything other than helping women who faint in the middle of his speeches by asking somebody to fetch a cup of water. Yes, such honesty from Perry and Romney would offer a refreshing surprise. What would not be as much of a surprise, moderate, reinvented Herman Cain in the hands of campaign advisors and tacticians. I hope it doesn't happen. GOP candidates, please, please, I implore you, just tell the truth. Just tell the stinking truth, even if the truth demands penance for a previous lie. Speak your mind and don't lose sleep over the next morning's New York Times editorial page as if they were looking for a Republican to support anyway. And don't lose sleep over some holiday celebrity's bizarre world definitions of hate and racism. If it costs you the election, you can at least go down in history as a person of integrity. Either way, roll the dice. Chances are such rare courage might win you the election anyway. Well, if you'd like to weigh in on any of this, our call-in toll-free number, 888-344-1170. Many people contacting us these days through Facebook, through Twitter, or directly to me, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. Concerning the comments I made earlier today about 9/11, and again, some of these people put nicknames down. We've heard from him before. Grouchy says, the radical rabs have no real interest in what we do or not do for the Israelis. Their animosity is toward us and has little to do with what we do. They are afraid of us because of who we are. My perception is that they hate our freedom from their ideology. I think you're right, my friend. Well, now, wait till you hear what Fred says. You're going to love what Fred has to say. He says, yes, and if we didn't bury our foreign policy noses in Israel's arse, we wouldn't have had 9/11. I'd rather have Arab oil than Jewish bagels. Just remember, 6,000 white American males have been killed for these two Jewish wars. What has Israel ever done for America? Fred, Israel is the only country in the Middle East that doesn't print anti-America propaganda in its newspapers. And Israel is our ally in the war on terror. Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East. I know we have places like Iraq that claim they have democracy. They also have Sharia law. But you already knew all this, didn't you, Fred? Your comments run much deeper than that. The venom of a snake is more easily excused than your vicious comment. But by all means, Fred, write me again. Always interesting to hear from an honest-to-goodness, ignorant anti-Semite. We'll be right back. Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
When the truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love.
I think Fred, who we heard from, I think he needs somebody to love. He sure doesn't love the Jews, but maybe he could love somebody. This next lady calls herself Mom's Had It. That's got to be the best nickname over the internet I've ever heard. Mom's Had It says this about Herman Cain. Mom says, I love this man. Tough, intelligent, and a real man. I'm voting this guy in hands down. And if Christie runs, that's our ticket. Start praying. and get moving. You know, Christie's a double-edged sword right now. What everybody loves about Christie is he talks so honestly, kind of like Kane. He's honest. He talks from the gut. Well, he's been talking honestly for the last year about how he emphatically is not going to run. And now his handlers say he might run after all. So if he decides to run after saying he wouldn't run, would the very honesty that made everybody love him be questionable? Just something to think about. This next guy calls himself B-Dogs, and B-Dogs says this about Christie. Christie is weak and liberal on too many issues. He's more liberal than Romney. That's true. Christie's very good with fiscal conservatism, moral conservatism, not as good. And this guy says Kane looks good. Well, moving on to our Bible section of the program, this question is from Logan. And I teased you with it a little earlier. Logan says, Bob, I want to know your opinion on something. Why, in your opinion, did Jesus claim that John the Baptist was Elijah, even though John himself had denied that claim? And he puts the two references down, Matthew 11, where Jesus said he was Elijah, John chapter 1, where John the Baptist said he was not Elijah. Logan, that is an excellent question. John the Baptist was not Elijah reincarnated or Elijah visiting from heaven, but Elijah the second. In other words, a person who was going to be coming in the spirit and power of Elijah. This was prophesied over baby Elijah in Luke. Luke chapter 1:17 actually explains all of it to us. A prophet prophesied over this baby John the Baptist, actually. I said baby Elijah, I meant baby John the Baptist. And what the prophet says about baby John the Baptist is he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. You see, Logan, the specific manifestation of the Holy Spirit that gave Elijah a unique ministry would also come upon John, just as it came upon Elijah's disciple, Elisha, different person, similar name. So it's an Elijah the second. That's what Jesus was talking about. But when the Pharisees talked to John the Baptist, they just asked him if he was actually the same person, Elijah from heaven. No, he was not Elijah returned from heaven. Yes, he was Elijah the second. Now, we have a whole host of questions from Glenda. Glenda says, it's a big leap to go from the Bible as an important record of how a people perceive their relationship and experiences with God to the Bible being inspired, almost dictated by that God. I'm not arguing against it. I'm just asking how we get there and whether it makes sense. Well, Glenda, good question. Not all of the Bible was dictated. Not all of the Bible makes that claim. Some of it was. Some of it was dictated, such as God's interaction with Moses on Mount Sinai and when he spoke to certain prophets after that. But often it is that when we say that the Bible is inspired by God, we mean it is God's message that was inspired. We don't mean that there's anything magic about the order of the words. For example, John 3:16 says, God so loved the world, he sent his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish, but receive everlasting life. Now, that's just the way they happen to say it. They could have said, God loves the world, he loves the world a lot. In fact, he cares about the world so much that he sent Jesus, and anybody who believes in Jesus will never die and live forever. See, that says the exact same thing, but it's different words. It's the message that is inspired. Now, Glenda continues. She says, Jesus told parables, which are fictional stories, so it's true he told those stories, but the stories themselves are not literally true. Isn't it possible that the early parts of Genesis and the beginning and ending of Job are also parables? Well, let me take on Job first. First of all, the style of Job, with the exception of the couple of chapters before and one after, the style of Job was written in the style of a play. It was written in that style. But Job was a real person who really existed. Later on in the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 4, Ezekiel refers to Job. God speaking through the prophet talks about Job having been a righteous man. Now, getting back to the parables, yes, the parables are just stories, stories with a point. The message of the parables are inspired by God. Jesus told one story. He might have chosen to tell a different story, but it is the message. As for the Genesis account is not written as a parable. It's written as a historical narrative with only one exception. Chapter 1 of Genesis was written as a poem. But Genesis is 50 chapters in length, and talks about far more than Adam and Eve. We would have to throw out the whole early history of Israel if we threw out Genesis, but this history of Israel is corroborated by other ancient history and by archaeology. And then she continues. She says, the Psalms may accurately reflect how the psalmist thought and felt, but that doesn't mean those thoughts and feelings were also God's. As example, the desire to bash out children's brains on a rock, God's abandonment of people. Yes, the Psalms were written as poetry. Some of them reflect the mood of God. Some of them reflect the mood of God's followers. She continues, if the Psalms are, at least in part, expressions of human thoughts and feelings, but not God's, why can't the epistles? Here she means the things written by Paul, Peter, some of the other, the letters. Epistles, another word for letter. Why can't the epistles, at least in part, also be the expression of the authors rather than God? Well, they are. They are an expression of the authors. Paul wrote many personal things in his letters, but, and this is very important, when Paul taught theology or issued commands to the church, then he was speaking under the inspiration of God. And she continues, no one takes all of the New Testament verses literally. For example, chopping off hands and feet, drowning oneself in a millstone. Yes, Jesus spoke often through hyperbole, but just as we can distinguish hyperbole today, we can distinguish it in Jesus' day. If I were to write a friend of mine in an email and go on for a while and then say, well, I'm getting hungry. I'm so hungry I can eat a horse. He would take that to mean that it's lunchtime. He would not take that to mean that I'm actually going to go out and eat horse meat. But supposing we had a great big earthquake and the hard drive of my computer was uncovered 3,000 years in the future and they hadn't uncovered anything else about America, that was the first thing they looked at my hard drive, their first conclusion might be that Americans ate horses. But after they uncovered other hard drives and books, they would realize that that was a figure of speech. We allow for figures of speech today. We've got to allow for figures of speech with the others. Glenda continues. She says, other than a few groups, for example, perhaps the Amish, I know of no one who still maintains women must cover their hair. Okay, it's in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 where they talk about women wearing a head covering. Men must have short hair. Women can't wear braids to church. Women must remain silent in church. We interpret those verses and come up with a meaning other than a literal one. Well, Glenda, yeah, some people come up with meanings and try to just make up what they want the Bible to say, but there's a much more objective process, and that's to study the culture. Let's start with women braiding their hair. It's actually in 1 Timothy chapter 2. It says women are not to braid their hair or wear jewelry. That is the way a prostitute dressed in those days. They braided their hair. They wear jewelry. So what we do is we take the concept, the transferable concept, women should be modest. If the Apostle Paul were writing today and he didn't want women to dress like prostitutes, he'd describe the way a prostitute dresses today. When women braid their hair or wear jewelry today, we don't think of them as prostitutes. And so the braided hair and the jewelry is a cultural limited command. The transferable concept is modesty. That's what we hold on to. Now, it does say in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 that women are to remain silent in the church. But Glenda, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, just one chapter previous, in the same letter, and this letter didn't have chapter divisions anyway, those were put in many years later, same author, same letter, in chapter 11, he mentions that women pray and prophesy in the church. And it's at that time that he says that a woman must pray and prophesy with her head covered. And now, Glenda, I know that's another one of your concerns, but let's just put a flag on that for now. Because sometimes looking at these verses like the pessimist or the optimist, pessimist sees the glass of water as half empty. Optimist sees it as half full. We get so hung up on the fact that the women are covering their head and we wonder about that. And it's a very fair question, Glenda, and I do appreciate it. We would want to ask that question. Why are women told to cover their heads? But because we're hung up on the head covering, we forget that women are praying and prophesying. Did you know that a prophet was one of the five authoritative offices in the early church? They're listed in Ephesians chapter 4. Pastor, teacher, evangelist, apostle, and prophet. So women are not only speaking in the church, they're praying in the church. They're prophesying in the church. They have a position of authority in the church. And if Paul lays this out in chapter 11, then when he gets to chapter 12 and says women must be silent, he must mean that women over one issue at one particular time in the church must be silent. And I'll tell you what that is when we return to the Bob Siegel Show, because we're never silent around here.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
We've got some really thoughtful, really sincere questions from Glenda, and I really appreciate how thoughtful and open she is being with the Bible. That's very much to your credit, Glenda. And she was bringing up, among other things, the command for women to be silent in the church, which is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. But I pointed out before we went to the break that back in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul was expecting that women would pray and prophesy in the church, so we know he's not saying that they have to be silent. So when the word silence comes up from the same author in the same letter, something else must be going on, and it is. In chapters 12, 13, and 14, Paul's talking about just a lot of confusion that's going on and disorderly conduct in the church service. For one thing, some of the prophets are speaking and talking over each other. And he tells them, if a prophecy comes to a second person, the first person should sit down. You need to take turns. And there's this supernatural gift, which I talked about a couple of weeks ago, called the gift of tongues. That was an ability, a supernatural ability given by the Holy Spirit to speak in a language you actually hadn't learned. But there was another ability, another gift called the gift of interpretation. And Paul said, if somebody speaks in tongues, somebody must interpret. Okay. So we know that order in a church service is what's concerning Paul. And he says, if people walk into your service and everybody's speaking in tongues at the same time, they're going to think you're mad. And we have church services today where everybody's speaking in tongues at the same time and a visitor walks in. You know what? Sometimes they think they're mad. We should listen to Paul. Paul spoke in tongues himself, but Paul believed in an orderly service. Well, something else was going on in those days. And here we'd have to look at some literature contemporary with the Bible, but go back through time a little bit. The early church, of course, grew out of Judaism. And the early church services and the kinds of buildings they built and the way their services were arranged grew out of the Jewish synagogue. In the ancient Jewish synagogue, and you can still see this today if you go to an Orthodox synagogue, the men and women sat on different sides. Also, in ancient Jewish culture and ancient Greece and ancient Rome, women were not very well educated. Most of the education went to the men. A lot of times people are accusing the Bible being this chauvinistic book. The Bible's actually very liberating, very egalitarian, because women are learning. Women are being taught. That's made very clear in 1 Timothy chapter 2, where Paul says that the women should be taught. They should learn, but they should do it in submission. They should not be too eager. They should realize that right now they have nothing to teach because they haven't learned anything yet. It was to the credit of the church. It was something new and vital and refreshing about Christianity that women were being educated. Okay, but up till now, the men and the women are sitting on different sides of the room. And when Paul says women should be silent, he says, if a wife has a question, let her ask her husband at home. That's the clue. What he's asking them to be silent about is not ask her husband a question. Now, why are they asking their husbands questions? Because they've never been educated before. And they're learning, and they're excited, and they're zealous, and they're enthusiastic. So, of course, they want to ask their husbands questions. But the only way to ask your husband a question if he's sitting on the opposite side of the room is to shout. And if Paul wanted tongues to be interpreted and he wanted prophets to take turns, he certainly didn't want women shouting questions to their husbands. And we know this is what he's talking about because he tells us that's what he's talking about. Let them ask at home. Okay, now back to the covering of hair. Here we get into a little Greek 401 here. I know, Greek. I'll try to make it more interesting than that. Sometimes the Greek, and of course the New Testament manuscripts were originally written in Greek, sometimes the Greek could read one way or could read another way. And occasionally you get a translation, such as the New International Version, which is honest enough to write in the footnotes an alternate way that it could go. And it says in the footnotes of the New International Version of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, that when it says the woman should wear a covering over her hair, that it could be that her long hair is itself the covering, or it could mean that she's wearing some kind of hat or veil. So the Greek could go one way, or it could go the other way. So what do we do? Do we toss a coin? Well, if that's the only information we have, we just have to say we don't know how it translates. But if the context reveals more, I will always let context tip the scale. Later on in the chapter, it says God has given her her hair as a covering. And where it says hair as a covering, nobody debates whether or not that's the accurate way to read the Greek. In other words, here's a place where it could say covering of hair or it could say covering over the hair. And that's debatable. But then later on, when Paul repeats it again, he says covering of hair. And this one, the Greek is not ambiguous. The scholars are not arguing about it. So I take that to mean the covering of hair is what he meant up there. He is saying women should wear long hair and men should wear short hair. Now, that's somewhat relative. He doesn't tell us how long the woman's hair has to be. He doesn't tell us how short the man's hair has to be. In every culture, hair length, whether long or whether short, points out whether a woman is looking effeminate or trying to look like a man, whether a man is looking effeminate or trying to look like a man or a woman. In other words, if the man's hair is so long that he's looking effeminate, if the woman's hair is so short that she's looking masculine, what Paul's saying here is women should not deny their femininity. Doesn't mean women aren't equal. Doesn't mean women can't be pastors. Doesn't mean women have to submit to their husbands, okay? It just means a woman should be happy she's a woman. Now, today, with all the talks about same-sex attraction and it just goes on and on, transgenders and sex change operations, we just see where all that leads to. And I know people like to talk a lot about tolerance, but here the Bible does tell us God made us male and female. And you may not like that, but you at least need to know that God's not telling women that they have to wear a head covering when they go to church. He's telling women to appreciate the fact that they're women and to not look like men. And I suspect that 99% of the women would agree with that. And if you're a woman who would rather look like a man, okay. I still respect you and God still loves you, but I'm just telling you what the Bible says here. Well, Glenda had a couple of other things to say. We'll look at them next week. She had a lot of good comments. Your comments and questions about the Bible are always welcome. We'll see you next week.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.